This Labor and Consumer Affairs evening will come to order. Thank you everyone for being here, and we will do our best to expedite the night and have it go as quickly as we can. We have seven bills to hear testimony on, and we're going to start with House Bill 3172 because Representative Patrick is with us. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3172.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3172 I brought at the request of Curtis Burrell, who happens to be a real estate person locally, who is also involved in economic development. The reason we brought the bill was to have kind of a statewide standard as to how long the permits and building permits and other licenses that people must get prior to building are open for a period of 2 years. The reason we brought the bill was we feel like it's important to let other people outside the state know that there's a standard out there that will be used by economic development throughout the state, and be able to just say that these permits are open for a period of 2 years so that we can then, we've talked a lot about shovel-ready dirt and other things in this legislative process this time. This would just have it out there for 2 years. I hadn't heard, people are aware that this bill's out there. I've gotten some good comments back that people think that would be fine, and I haven't heard any negatives. I expected cities and counties to come to me if there were negatives, but I hadn't heard anything. But basically, the bill is very simple. It's a one-paragraph bill, and that's the intent of it, is to continue to encourage economic development by having the period of time done in an appropriate measure.
Thank you, Representative Patrick. Are there questions for the representative? Thank you very much. And that concludes our testimony on House Bill 3172.
Thank you.
Closing the public hearing, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3172.
Madam Chair.
Representative Girard.
I would move, I'm sorry, I forget.
3172.
House Bill 3172, the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Girard moves House Bill 3172 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Abel. Aye.
Representative Girard.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Is excused.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Pitts.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Chair Close.
Close aye. Representative Merkley.
Aye.
I was late.
Thank you very much. House Bill 3172 passes to the floor. And Representative Patridge, would you like to carry it?
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the work. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2331. Call Representative Butler forward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. Thank you very much for the opportunity of hearing 2331. 2331 comes to you as a result of a couple of issues. Number one, some rather significant changes in the accounting industry and licensure nationwide as a result of the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants requiring a greater certification level nationwide. And then second of all, originally the board was going to go ahead and try and get this in under its own requirements early on, and failed to receive timely notice from the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. What it allows us to do is to go ahead and continue to reciprocally license those other accountants from other states who, by virtue of the fact that they're receiving an abundance of credits in non-directly accounting-related items, come out with multiple degrees, one of which will be an accounting license in another state and be certified as certified public accountants, but then don't qualify because of the old rule in Oregon that your primary course must be in accounting.
Questions for Representative Butler? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call Carol Reed, Board of Accountancy. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reeves. I'm the administrator for the Board of Accountancy, and Representative Butler was very helpful to carry this bill for us. since we did not recognize the need for it until it was past the time that we were able to introduce bills on our own behalf. Information that's being passed out to you right now includes copies of the bill, fiscal impact, and what the purpose of the bill is. 673040 is the General Licensing Authority for Certified Public Accountants and Public Accountants. House Bill 2331 makes the following changes. First of all, and very important, is that it restores the authority for the Board to issue licenses by reciprocity. The provisions were inadvertently removed during the 01 legislative session, and we need to have them restored. This is important because certified public accountants who are licensed in another jurisdiction and who wish to be licensed in Oregon might be required to retake the exam and re-qualify by experience requirements if it were not for the reciprocity provisions. In addition to that, many states do not reciprocate with other states that do not themselves have reciprocity provisions. If Oregon does not have reciprocity provisions, then our own licensees are limited to their ability to reciprocate to other states as well. This is an important feature that we need to have restored. Secondly, this bill adds chartered accountants to the reciprocity provisions as those who may be eligible for reciprocity to Oregon. There are certain reciprocity licensing agreements that have been negotiated with the countries of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand for chartered accountants in those countries, and they have been determined to be substantially equivalent to the requirements of a CPA in the United States. With this authority, the Board of Oregon would be allowed to offer reciprocity to chartered accountants from any of those countries with which there has been a reciprocity licensing agreement negotiated. This is also important for our licensees who are in other parts of the world who wish to practice in those countries because the reciprocity, again, goes two ways. Third, the bill amends the requirements for the supervisor licensee to have an active license for a period of 5 years in order to provide the supervision that's required for the experience eligibility requirement for those who wish to become licensed in Oregon. And it also allows the board to establish a minimum time frame in which all eligibility requirements must be met. Eligibility requirements include taking of the examination and obtaining experience in a public accounting firm or an equivalent firm. The purpose of this is to make sure that the experience and the exam requirements have been met within a period of time that makes them relevant to today's profession. The profession moves quickly. Competency is something that is continually changing, and it is maintained through your continuing education requirements. So these two provisions will assist the board in protecting the public by making sure that anyone who's licensed in Oregon is indeed competent and meets the minimum requirements for licensing. Finally, the board does include an emergency clause so that the reciprocity provision in particular will go into effect immediately upon signing. I'm willing to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Reeves, your fiscal analysis shows a revenue reduction of $40,000, but that would result if we did not pass this bill. Is that right? So passage of the bill, we would bring in that $40,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that is correct. That is the average amount that we receive for reciprocal licenses. And so if the reciprocity provision is not restored, we would lose that revenue. So it is a revenue reduction if the bill does not pass. The bill by itself has no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carol. Very
Thank
complete.
You so much.
Okay, that concludes our testimony on House Bill 2331. I'm closing the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2331. Representative Rosenbaum.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2331 be sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2331 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berkley?
Aye.
Representative Shoffley?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. And I'm going to have Representative Butler carry the bill, if he would.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we're closing the work session on House Bill 2331. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3274, calling Commissioner Nyquist. He with us. There he is. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3274 requires the Department of Human Services to notify a county health department of location of certain temporary restaurants. It requires operator of a mobile unit to notify county health department when unit is relocated to a county other than the county that it's licensed in. Thank you.
Welcome, Commissioner. It's been a big day. You've had several bills up.
Yeah. Well, I hope this one goes better than this morning. I was propelled for a 7 or 8 mile run after this morning's event. I don't think I have it left in my legs to do it again tonight. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Roger Nyquist. I'm a Linn County Commissioner on behalf of Linn County. And this is a fairly simple proposition, I hope. We in Linn County just want to know who it is that is selling food in our county. As the law and the administrative rules currently exist, there's an opportunity for temporary licenses or mobile food units to come through Linn County or any other county for that matter, and to do business without notifying us. And you could have a situation where a vendor is in selling food, they're gone. The next day we have an outbreak of foodborne illness, and we need to know who it is that was doing business the day before and attempt to be able to track that down. And this bill would accomplish that for us.
Well, it's a very interesting concept, especially going into a era of terrorism, so I appreciate you bringing it. Representative Kitts.
I just have a question. If someone, when you fill out your paperwork to do business with the state, you check off what counties you'll be doing business in currently. I would assume, and I don't know if it's, I just don't want to be redundant in what we require. So if I were to start a mobile restaurant, one of these cafe or whatever you want to call it, carts, and I checked off that I'll be traveling into X, Y, and Z counties of business, I then have to register that. Would that not take care of what you're talking about here?
Now, as I understand the mobile food license licensing provision, that you have a primary license location, and that can be in any county. And I haven't seen the form, so I don't know that it requires checkoff of all counties you'll be doing business in or not. I certainly do know that there's no obligation of other counties to notify us that they've gotten this license and these folks will be there. And furthermore, when it's on a mobile deal like that, and it may be only 2 or 3 days a year they're going to be in our county, we'd like to know when it is they're going to be there, and that they are, in fact, they're doing business there. On the temporary license, the notification would come from DHS, I believe, because they do, in fact, at that time, fill out a form as to where they'll be and when they'll be there, and it would be the obligation of the person granting the license to notify us.
Can I do a follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
So, with your bill, it would then... Would they get this in advance? I guess my concern is I don't want to create another layer of difficulty for small businesses out there. So would it be they would apply for this permit, if you will, in advance to say or fill out this form to say I am going to be working with my mobile food unit at the softball tournament at Field X?
What the only thing, the only additional burden on the mobile food unit or small business would be that they would, in fact, have to notify the county that they're going to be doing business in our county. So in that case, if they're going to operate a mobile food unit over the weekend at a softball tournament, they would need to notify us of that.
Would they have some follow-up?
Follow-up.
Would they have to do this every time? So I mean, I only say this out of concern. I mean, if someone were traveling, you know, on these as these mobile things do, you may event to event to event. You know, they could be in Linn County for breakfast. You know, at some, you know, and we all know we've all worked, you know, job sites where they come to the job site. I don't want to. You understand where I'm going?
I do understand what you're saying, and they would need to notify us if they knew their schedule. I mean, they wouldn't, if they knew they were going to be in Linn County every week or every day, they wouldn't need to notify us every day. But they would need to spell out in a letter of notification that they were going to be there and what days they did intend on doing business. And they could do that, you know, annually like they do their license. I don't know that the bill specifically spells out which it is. It just says they have to notify us.
Okay.
Commissioner, Section 2 talks about that the person getting the temporary restaurant permit has to notify the department orally or in writing. Would that be in your intent with this bill, too, that they could notify also orally? I mean, they could pick up the phone and call Linn County. They wouldn't be required to do it in writing. Is that true?
That would, on the mobile, when it comes to the mobile food units, I believe that's correct. I'm trying to read it here and see if it spells out. Because on the temporary license, the burden is not on the vendor, it's on the agency.
Other questions? Representative Gerard.
I might also mention, on behalf of the commissioner, as a fellow former commissioner, a lot of problems with these mobile units are public health. In that restrooms have to be located a certain distance from some of these establishments, etc. And so it really is a tremendous aid for an office in the county to be able to track where they are and when they're there, because quite often we don't know they're around. So.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading the first section of your bill, and it notes that the location of a temporary restaurant is in a delegate county other than a delegate county issuing a license. Department should notify the county health department. Just to make sure, I'm a little confused here because I have the impression the Department of Human Services is issuing the license. Is the license actually issued from a county, or are we saying it is issued? What are we referring to here when we say the delegate county issuing the license?
When you get when a vendor gets a restaurant license, that it's issued by a county.
Okay, but how's the Department of Human Services involved then?
I think they're probably not.
Madam Chair, I'll just say I'm still confused because the language in the previous paragraph says that the license comes from the Department of Human Services.
Are you in Section 2?
No, Section 1. Section 1, Sub 1, line 5 and 6. Cannot operate without procuring a license from the Department of Human Services.
Mm-hmm. And then in Section 2, if they're going to go temporary, they have to notify the department orally or in writing in Section 2. And so the addition is this correct, Commissioner? The addition is that they'd also have to notify the county, that the department would.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Does that clarify it?
I can only speak from both a vendor and the county's end. Certainly, the Department of Human Services is beyond my scope of ability to testify here this evening.
I'll add one more question.
Okay.
If in fact we can give the vendor the responsibility to notify counties other than the county of record, if you will, when it's operating there, why not have the vendor take that responsibility in all cases? Because since it's a mobile unit, isn't it essentially, even within a county, going to have a different agenda or a different location from day to day, week to week, month to month? And therefore, aren't we setting up a situation where the vendor's having to call DHS, DHS is having to call the county, so on and so forth, like repeatedly?
Again, I can only speak to the counties, and I can speak as a vendor. I'm not completely familiar with the process of the temporary license and the how and the where of all of that and why that's presented the way it is. Again, we just want to know who's selling food in our county and when they're selling it.
Any other questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah.
admitting my question. Is there somebody from DHS going to be?
No, they have not signed up to testify.
Because are you then aware of the relationship? Then I have the same question about DHS and the county health department. Can you describe that relationship?
I probably am not qualified to. We issue restaurant license, and then we supervise the preparation and sale of food in our county. And
And does your local health department then issue the help the certificate?
Restaurant license.
The restaurant license.
They do.
Temporary restaurant license. Because this is speaking about a license that's issued from DHS, and the responsibility of the folks here is DHS.
I believe, again, I'm
confused.
I believe DHS has the ability to grant temporary restaurant licenses as well.
And I believe that is in Section 2 where it says ORS 624025 that they shall grant, they shall issue the license for the temporary restaurant. So they already have the information correct. Is my guess.
I believe that's correct.
Madam Chair?
I'm saying Schaffler.
Why don't we just take human services out of this and say they have to notify the county? Why call the Salem so Salem has to call the county?
Because they are issuing the license. Because DHS is issuing the license. And the county isn't.
Forgive me, but I haven't even really interpreted that in every case. That's maybe I'm just totally ignorant of this, but if a county hands out some license and human services do some, then all we care about is that the county's informed, which that sounds perfectly reasonable to me. Why not just say they don't have to call human services and they only have to call the county that they're doing business in and forget about where they got their license? That just seems to be...
Well, my guess is, and maybe Roger can help us, when they issue this license, they have to verify that things are done according to health rules, health division rules.
Well, that's correct. And it gets back to Representative Pitt's concern of creating another level of bureaucracy or burden on a licensee going to do business temporarily when DHS would already have that information and could as easily do that.
Okay, let's go to Department of Human Services. They are here, and they would like to clarify your question. So would they come forward, please? And please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Pippert with Department of Human Services.
Could you address the concerns of the committee that they're not clear on these temporary restaurant licenses, and the maybe you could tell us the process you go when you issue them. Do you issue them, and how do you do it?
Madam Chair, the temporary restaurant licenses are issued by the delegate county health departments. It's part of the statute that says the department shall issue the license without a license to do so. From the department in Section 1 is the broad part of the statute that gives us the authority for the program, which we then delegate to the county health departments. So the county health departments are acting as our agents when they issue the licenses.
And so are you looking at the bill? The boldface there says that if it's in a different location than the delegate county, then how do they find out?
Madam Chair, generally speaking, this is a non-issue. When operators are setting up temporary restaurants at events, unless it's by some accident, they would go to the local health department where that temporary event is occurring and purchase the license from that health department.
And do you have those in every county?
There are 26 delegate counties and 10 counties that are direct service counties, which the service is provided from our office.
And do you have that in Linn County?
Madam Chair, Linn County is the delegate county health department, and they do the licensing of the restaurants in their county.
So you're saying that the county health department should be doing this notification? Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm saying there would be no need for notification because the temporary restaurant operator would receive the license from the county in which they intended to operate their temporary restaurant.
Roger, can you tell us, is that happening in Lincoln?
I don't know of a case where somebody's purchased a temporary license from another county and came in to sell food in our county. I believe that's correct.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric, it seems like maybe the confusion is the difference between a temporary restaurant and a mobile unit, because Section 1 of this bill talks about a temporary restaurant, which existing law says a license applicant has to give the specific location of the temporary restaurant, and that license is only good for 30 days, or if they cease to exist or move, the license terminates on the removal. So that section seems like it really is talking about a stationary location, and you apply for a specific location, whereas mobile unit in Section 3 does talk about having an itinerary for a mobile unit that can be moved around from place to place. So I'm wondering maybe if that's the section that you're really concerned about, is a unit that can be moved, because a temporary restaurant can't be moved without getting a new license.
That is absolutely correct.
Eric, is it a problem for the department to direct their delegate counties to notify, such as the skills again?
Madam Chair, you're referring to Section 1.
I'm looking at Section 2, actually.
Section 2. Madam Chair, that is a non-problem because operators go to the county in which they intend to operate when to purchase their license. These temporary restaurants are the food booths that are set up at Art Fair for 3 days, things of that nature, the state fair, those kind of events. And when they operate, they buy their license immediately prior to operating from the local health department. So the notification would be a non-issue. It would be unnecessary except for in rare circumstances when someone mistakenly sold a license to someone intending to operate in another county in another location. The license application for temporary restaurants asks for information of the event that the operator intends to operate at, and a county would be expected to recognize that it's not here. You know, Art Fair's in Salem, not in Gresham, and would direct the person to the proper health department from which to purchase their license.
So if a person in Benton County has one of these temporary licenses and you know, they're only 10 miles from Albany, they go over there, which is now Linn County, they don't notify anybody. Is that already illegal?
Madam Chair, a temporary restaurant is a distinct animal from a mobile unit. A temporary restaurant is licensed to operate at a fixed location for the duration of the event.
Only?
Only. Community event, and that's that. And a mobile unit is licensed differently and is expected to be mobile.
I want to give Commissioner Nyquist a chance to respond to the department.
Well, I agree with the department, and that just, if I can, again, this is a great idea, and it's real simple. A temporary restaurant license purchased in Benton County is not good in Linn County, so this is a non-issue, as I understand it, right? Okay, so we're back to however the language got there, and whatever it says probably is not neither the focus of the bill or the purpose, and is not a deterrent from passage of this legislation.
Okay. Representative Merkman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it sounds to me like your real interest is in the mobile units, And your concern is when if you get a license from one county and then you drive across a line, can you with that license keep operating? And if so, the other county ought to know. If I understand that correct, is that correct?
Correct.
Then my question to the department is, can I obtain a mobile restaurant license from Multnomah County and utilize that in Clackamas County?
Madam Chair, Representative Markley, yes.
And is there any process in place currently to let Clackamas County Health Department know that they have this mobile unit operating in Clackamas County?
Madam Chair, Representative Markley, no, there is not a process at this time to require them to notify, although, as in your example, being licensed in Multnomah County and operating in Clackamas County, Clackamas County could require that mobile unit to be licensed, or they could have a reciprocity agreement with Multnomah County and allow them to operate without being licensed. In point of fact, them whether they know that mobile unit is operating in their county is probably unlikely.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gallegos, and then we're going to move on.
Well, I think the questions Representative Merkley helped address mine. I think what you're saying is you didn't ask for this other wording about the temporary restaurants redone, and that's because that's what we're looking at. They amended the bill to amend the wording about temporary restaurants.
That would be correct, Representative. Thank you.
Okay, but it's not clear. Does your county request a? Or do you have reciprocal agreements? You don't have them, and that's why you need this. Or are other counties not going to need this?
We don't have them, and it's hard to do, especially being on the I-5 corridor. I mean, I can paint you a scenario where a vendor sold food in six different counties in a three-day period, and you could have a foodborne illness problem, and the counties wouldn't even know they were there.
Okay, Commissioner Nyquist, what I would like you to do is work with Eric on this and amend the bill, and we would like to bring it back and clarify what your real intent is.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3274. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2847. Call Grover Simmons. And the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2847 requires the Department of Transportation, when determining the lowest responsible bidder to contract to purchase motor vehicle plates, to estimate economic impact of awarding contract to non-resident bidder. It also requires the department in 2003 to advertise for bids on public contract for license plates on the first anniversary of the date such public contract was executed in 2002, and it declares an emergency upon passage. We have -1 amendments before you tonight, and it deletes most of the bill except for the provision that requires the department to during this year to advertise for bids on a public contract for license plates on the first anniversary of the date of their current contract, and it maintains the emergency clause as well. And there's the no fiscal impact statement yet on this. Thank you.
Okay, committee. So you may notice the body of the bill is gone from Section 1 down to Section 2. Section 2 is the emergency clause. Grover.
Good evening, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Employer Association. And as the staff has pointed out, the -1 amendment simply is an excerpt from the original bill, which looked much larger and was much more complicated. But you've accomplished everything in that bill by passage of 2846 a week ago or so. So what's left is this one point relating to what we are prepared to testify on this evening. The situation which House Bill 2847 calls to your attention and which we're asking you to do something about is the fact that whenever the purchasing division awards a public contract for to buy state license plates, the contract is for 1 year. But at the option of the division, it can be extended four times more. In reality, the duration of the contract could be for 5 years. HB 2847 would require that the Department of Transportation, through the purchasing division, put the contract out to bid in 2003 instead of rolling it over for a longer period of time, as much as four more years. This would give an opportunity for a Portland-based company to bid on the contract, and if the company is the lowest responsible bidder, it would allow perhaps the bringing back of this license plate work from bringing it back to Oregon from Canada, and we would benefit from the continued employment or reemployment of a minimum of 15 people. I'm told that we could lose, frankly, the entire metals division at Irwin-Hodson, which is 30 people. It's in a state of jeopardy now, but clearly a minimum of 15 jobs are involved. The value of the one-year public contract which went to Canada was $2,660,000. A full five-year contract could be worth $13,300,000. And as I mentioned, a minimum of 15 family wage manufacturing jobs are involved.
Robert, we have had testimony on that other bill already.
Yeah, it's a, so passing a law which simply tells the state government to put the job out to a bid in 2003 instead of automatically rolling it over would be pro-Oregon, pro-jobs, and a piece of legislation which, in my view, would be good public policy, and we urge your support.
Thank you very much. Does the committee have questions? Do you understand that this is, goes with the companion bill 2846? Representative Shoffer.
Thank you. Mr. Simmons, what percentage of the license plate did Hobson?
Irwin-Hodson.
Irwin-Hodson. What percentage of their business overall has come from in the past state of Oregon?
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, there are people from the company here who could answer that question exactly. Mr. Tom Brown, for example, sitting on my right, I'm sure he'd be happy to address that.
Or if you have a ballpark. I'm not against this.
Frankly, Irwin-Hodson is a major commercial printing establishment, and they have a metals division, which is a significant part of their work, but it's not the whole company by any means.
Representative Shoffler, the bill is about moving the anniversary date. That's why I want you to keep your questions to that.
And they're going to take their evidence to that hearing when that comes up. Is that correct? When the bid goes back out, you'll make your case there rather than here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I want.
Yes, that's all. The bid would just be put out for bid. The contract would be put out for bid again.
This just moves the data.
It does.
That's all this is about.
And I'm in total support of that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
I apologize. We're trying to move as quickly as we can.
I appreciate
you bearing with us. Okay, that completes the testimony on this bill. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2847. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2847. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2847.
Representative Gallegos moves the -1 amendment into House Bill 2847. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2847 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 2847 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, does it have a fiscal? It doesn't have a subsequent referral?
It does not.
Okay. That's my only question.
And if you look at your staff sheet, it says may have fiscal impact, but no statement yet issued.
Okay. The fiscal office is working on the information they were providing. They just have to go through the contracting process again, the bidding process.
Okay, and there would be a new bidding process.
All the significant stuff is in the bill.
Right, the bill that we had testimony on and passed. Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler? Representative Berard.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Chopper.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Chair Post.
Votes aye. Motion carries. And Representative Smith, Representative T. Smith will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2172. Call the PEB people forward, Malia Christensen, David Hartwig, and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2172 grants Public Employees Benefit Board explicit authority to provide self-insurance programs, permits deductions from state employees' wages to pay for self-insurance benefits under rules, procedures, and directions of the board. There's no fiscal impact on this bill, and it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so if the committee chose to, that would need to be rescinded, but we did get a no fiscal impact on this bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Malia Christensen. I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board, and I have with me this evening David Hartwig, who's the administrator of the Risk Division for the State of Oregon and is also serving as the PEB chair this year. I also send my regards from two other board members who are unable to attend the hearing this evening. One is Representative Krupp, who is a board member of PEB and also served on the Self-Insurance Task Force, and the other is Rocky King, an administrator with the state who is the chair of the Self-Insurance Task Force. They urge your consideration and passage of the bill. Quite quickly, because we understand your schedule is very tight this evening, 2172 would provide PEB with the administrative language needed to self-insure a program in the future if and when the board decides that it's in the best interest of the state and in the best interest of employees. We're going to cover just a quick couple of items for you that deal with the task force highlights, and then David's going to talk a little bit about the board perspective, and we'd be delighted to answer any of your questions. The legislature in 97 gave PEB its mission quite succinctly. It is to provide high-quality benefits at a cost that's affordable to the state and to the employees. As most of you know, PEB has not been immune to the marketplace forces and the dramatic increases in the cost of health insurance. The board has been busy looking for alternatives, and in 2002 had a task force look specifically at the issue of self-insurance. This was spurred in part by PEB's request for proposal nationally for medical benefits, prescription drug benefits, and also innovation proposals. We did not receive a single bid nationally for PEB's business, and we only received one bid from an Oregon carrier that could offer a statewide program for PEB. So very difficult times and very difficult situation. The task force that I mentioned again was chaired by Rocky King, Representative Krupp. David Hartwig also provided a membership to that committee. There were several months of work that that group did, and in short, the group recommended to the board, and the board approved that PEB make sure that in its options for the future, self-insurance existed, not because they're going to do it eminently, but instead because they wanted to make sure it was in their option. The board also invited PEB's general counsel to come and visit with the board. The AG has basically told PEB that our statutes are already broad enough to provide the authority to self-insure, but what we lacked is the technical language to administer the program of self-insurance if we need to in the future. I'll let David summarize for you some of the highlights in terms of the board's perspective, and then I'll cover a few quick technical items.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Hartwig. In 1997, the legislature, through Oregon Revised Statute 243.285, authorized PEB to employ whatever means are necessary, are reasonably necessary, to carry out the purposes of Oregon Revised Statute 243.105 through 285 and 292.051. The statute goes on to further clarify that the board is to contract for a health benefit plan or plans best designed to meet the needs and provide for the welfare of eligible employees and the state. The statute encourages the board to be innovative, creative, and flexible. We believe that self-insurance as an option would enable us to be more creative, innovative, and flexible. By way of comparison, nationally, 68% of all large employers self-insure some portion of their health plan. Oregon Revised Statute 731.036 already allows cities, counties, and community colleges to self-insure. At a minimum, House Bill 2172 allows PEB to have it at its disposal, a tool that is available to most employers. Having the option to self-insure promotes more competition because it allows a variety of vendors to compete for PEB's business. Self-funding is not viewed by the board as a silver bullet, but rather as a reasonable and necessary option for the board to consider during its annual renewal benefit planning process. If at some point in the future PEB decides to self-insure, it would continue to comply with all state and federal mandates and assessments. Self-insurance provides PEB with the tool to pursue alternative programs. We see this as vital to supporting our legislative mission to offer quality and affordability to employees in the state. And with that, I'll refer back to Malia.
Just a quick follow-up on the technical. The sightings that are here allow really for practical issues for administration, like where does the money go, how is the benefit termed. A lot of the language has to do with contracts because it was written to assume insurance contracts, and we've added language that would state that self-insurance is one of those options. We also cleaned up under Section 1A at the request of Legislative Council some dated language to say medical, dental, life insurance benefits instead of supplemental life and medical benefits. And with that, I'll stop and entertain any questions or concerns in the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Apparently we have none. You've done a great job.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes our testimony in House Bill 2172. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2172. We have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, we don't have a fiscal impact, so if we wish to rescind the referral, we need to do so. Representative Kibbs.
We wish to rescind the referral.
I think so.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept House Bill 2172, rescinding the referral, and move it to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Representative Kibbs moves to rescind the referral to Ways and Means and move House Bill 2172 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Good idea.
Representative Gallegos?
Well, my question would be, since this would allow this to happen in the future, is there in the future a potential fiscal impact and because of this action today where we have created the statute and authority to go create this a fiscal impact without that review?
I think that probably, I can't speak for legislative fiscal, I think they would say they cannot, it has an indeterminate impact. They can't determine it because it hasn't happened yet. Okay. And it would depend on market conditions, I would think. Yeah. Other comments? Representative Merkley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just theoretically, the fiscal impact would be positive. It's an idea designed to save money for benefits, which will in turn save money for the state. It's a great idea.
Okay. Other comments? All right. Clerk will call the roll.
President
Daniels?
Aye.
President
Gerard?
Is excused.
Aye.
President Kaufman?
Aye.
President
Kiss?
Aye.
President
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair
votes. Votes aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2172 moves to the floor. And we need a carrier. Representative Rosenbaum? Representative Rosenbaum will carry the bill. Closing the work session, 172. Thank you, committee. We've gotten through the bills, which are the shortest to deal with. And now we have two left. And we have Representative Berger in the room, and she needs to come forward. And the staff will read the... I'm sorry, not quite. We're opening a public hearing on House Bill 3021, and the staff will read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3021 requires dealers and distributors to keep and submit certain records to Oregon Liquor Control Commission, requires the OLCC to report findings annually to the legislature, and provides that record submitting and reporting requirements are operative on January 1st, 2005.
Thank you, Representative, for bearing with us. I know you've been waiting, and we apologize and appreciate.
Thank you very much, Chair Close, members of the committee. I appreciate your indulgence in hearing this bill. This bill basically concerns the Oregon Bottle Bill, and I have a certain history with the Oregon bottle bill, which I won't go into. But the bottle bill has served us for over 30 years. It's an important piece of legislation. It's an icon in this state. And the reason that it has worked very well is because the industry, who this was voiced upon, responded after much screaming and kicking by making it work. But it is a complex, complicated system, and I think it is in desperate need of updating and reworking to make it more workable now and certainly workable into the future. Retailing has changed in 30 years. Technology has changed in 30 years. And if you look out on our streets and highways, you're going to see an awful lot of non-returned bottles like it was when this thing was originated. So to that end, I am a freshman and don't have the energy and don't have the information necessary to really rework this in an intelligent manner. So what you're looking at here is what I believe is the first step. Because there is this mystery pot of money surrounding the bottle bill. And what this bill addresses is there some way we can get a handle on whether it exists and how much it might be? The point is this. When Oregonians go to the grocery store or anywhere else in the state, they pay a nickel for every bottle bill container. Then a certain amount are returned, and that amount appears to be quite some number less than was purchased in the first place. So every time one doesn't come back, there's a nickel. And it seems like peanuts until you read, for instance, the best report on what this amount would be, and that comes from DEQ, and they do a kind of a dumpster diving study that indicates that something like 16% end up in landfills, and they extrapolate, and they come up with a very sizable amount of money to me, $10.5 million a year. That's not peanuts. Now, if you talk to the distributors, they'll tell you that that's the wrong number. The real number is zero, because everybody in Washington is dumping their cans and bottles on us, too. So what I'm trying to get at here with this bill is simply a way to find out that number. Have it counted. Have the OLCC record it. Now, there is a fiscal impact here. OLCC estimates it would cost a half-time person to just basically monitor this. If DEQ is even close to right at $10.5 million that Oregonians are paying but are disappearing somewhere, I think a half-time person is worth finding out. That's what it goes about. I thank you for your indulgence. Question?
Thank you, Representative. I understand your father was instrumental in the original bottle bill. Is that true?
I told you I wouldn't get into this because your time is short. My father originated the bottle bill. I'm the only living witness to the actual birth of the Oregon bottle bill. It was his passion, and he died shortly after its implementation. And it's a little known fact of history. It is written somewhere. And I cut my teeth on Oregon politics with regard to the bottle bill. I was pretty young at the time. I was 30 years old.
You were one, right?
Yeah, right. Right. Actually, I was in high school when it started, and it had a huge impact on my sense that as an individual, you can go out in this process and make a big difference, because I watched it happen.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a number of witnesses. So I'll just start down the list here. I'm going to call up, I think we'll go for and against. We'll alternate. I'll bring up Sandra Bishop, Container Recovery, and Paul Romaine.
There's $10 million out there somewhere. I don't know the landfill.
We need to hear the test.
Too late.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Chair Close, members of the committee. I'd like to introduce something into the record that I just discovered this afternoon. It's from 1971 session and from a gentleman named Rich Chambers. It's out of the archives. I had a very relaxing afternoon walking by the creek on the way to the archives and found that one of the foremost proponents of the bottle bill was indeed Mr. Chambers. And I apologize for the color on the copies, and I only have one for the record, but it came from the archives. This is what you'll find in the archives. The reason the copies are so dark is he was an excellent presenter and he had them all in on colored paper, which makes it difficult to copy, but you'll see there's a lot of background information on the bottle bill and what happened. To go back to the 71 session, the bottle bill was intended to deal with a litter problem. So we'll start from there. I'll just hit the high points in my testimony. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here this afternoon representing Container Recovery, Inc. Container Recovery was incorporated in 1987. In the Portland area, it was incorporated by the Portland distributors to collect, account for, and recycle redeemed containers. And it started operation in 1988. Crink deals with the containers that are covered under the bottle bill in Oregon, which are those which have malt or carbonation. That's what triggers our bottle bill. Oregon's bottle bill is the first in the nation. It is still the best. We have the highest recycling rate or redemption rate in the United States. The average annual redemption rate in Oregon for deposit containers is somewhere around 97-98%. The way we come up with those figures is that Crink picks up 53%, picks up in accounts from recycles, 53% of the total number of containers sold in the state that are covered by our deposit. We do about a 1 billion, that's billion with a V, 1 billion containers a year. We're processing about 3 million containers every day. We're operating right now in 5 counties, including Marion County, Yamhill, and the Tri-County area in Portland. Crink is set up as an agent of the beer and wine distributors. It's a cooperative, so it's not set up to make money. It's set up to put the bottle bill into work, and that's what it does. Because of this, it really makes Crink one of the only, quote, experts in the state. We know not only what makes the bottle bill work, but what's going to make it not work, and that's what we're here to talk with you about today. Right now, there is no public money in the Oregon bottle bill. The distributors are responsible for the system for redemption and recycling. In the law, you have to recycle. You can't just simply pick up the containers and landfill them. You actually have to recycle them. And if you'll notice in the Crink brochure, there's some fact sheets in there about the tonnage that we do in aluminum and the other commodities each year. Basically, the cost of Oregon's bottle bill is borne by the distributors, who pay about $7 million a year to, in addition, they're paying that $7 million a year to operate Container Recovery up in Portland. And that's about 50-some percent of the cost in the state, because we do 53% of the total number. So around other areas of the state, in Bend, for instance, or far reaches of eastern Oregon, the individual distributors are putting in even more money to pay the cost of recycling. And basically, what House Bill 3021 requires, or seems to attempt to require, is that all retailers in Oregon would be required to report not only the redemption of containers, but also their sales figures. And I think there's been some confusion about who would actually report. A dealer, the definition of dealer, is anyone who is holding an off-premise license in the state of Oregon. So we're talking about every bar and tavern in Oregon, every grocer, and a certain number of restaurants. Any place you can go and purchase something and take it off-site. And the main reason that we're opposing it is because you're really going to, if you try to get this kind of reporting and change the bottle bill like this, I believe that the bottle bill system in Oregon will implode. And you will find that it's going to be very expensive. You're going to have to put a lot of public money into it. The only way you can do these kind of reports is to somehow impose a layer of government onto the retailers and the licensees. Because right
so
now...
I hate to interrupt you, but we have about 4 minutes per person on this bill.
Sure.
So
I'll quickly sum up. Right now, the nickel, when you go into the retailer to buy a container... buy a beer, you buy a soda, that nickel is simply put into the till. There's no separate accounting system for that. So there's no public money in there that going in there to say, okay, this is what it would cost to get it back out. So a couple of sessions ago, the Department of Revenue was asked what it would cost to just do a study to find out how you could set up a system to capture, quote, the extra, if there's extra unredeemed in the system. The quote at the time was $500,000 just for the study. So we would recommend that you not proceed with something like this because it's going to be, if there were a lot of money in the system, we probably would have found it by now and the distributors wouldn't be paying Crink $7 million a year to do the... to run the operation. And the statistics are already there. If you take the... there are audited numbers out of Crink, so we're audited annually. If you take those audited figures and do a simple mathematical extrapolation, that's probably the best way to find the redemption rate. The OLCC is cutting positions. They're proposing to cut over 15 positions. The type of positions they're cutting are enforcement positions, which means that you're jeopardizing your liquor control system. So if you're asking the OLCC to shift folks to this, that's taken away from something else.
Thank you very much. We're out of time.
One other thing.
Paul, what I would like to do is call up, before you testify, we have one man who lives more than 100 miles away, and I inadvertently overlooked that. So I'd like to call John Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Clark.
Okay, is it Alex Tyler or Doug Myers that live more than 100 miles away? I'd like to take your testimony so that you can get on the road if you need to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm the chair of the Association of Oregon Recyclers, and I'm employed by the City of Eugene as a recycling analyst. The Association of Oregon Recyclers has approximately 300 members. Our commitment is to making the most of what we've got, and we are frustrated anytime we see materials that are recyclable being landfilled. I have a particularly bad habit of looking into garbage cans wherever I go. And the first thing I did when I entered this room was look into the garbage can at your doorway. There's two beverage containers in your garbage can, a coffee cup and a napkin. And I noticed that many of you committee members are drinking out of beverage containers this afternoon, as well as many members of the audience. Anytime a beverage container is landfilled in the state of Oregon, this represents an unredeemed deposit. And the unredeemed deposit, that nickel that has gone away, has actually gone into the industry's pocket, into the distributor who's handling those containers. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that the industry has invested a significant amount of money into capturing these containers, sorting them out, accounting for the nickels. It's an immensely complex system. But as a sponsor of this bill indicated, this was written 30 years ago when many of the containers and the beverage types that you're drinking today did not even exist. This bill needs to be changed. And in fact, all the bottle bills that came after our illustrious model here have a way to capture these unredeemed deposits. The state of Massachusetts has brought in over $281 million from unredeemed deposits in the last 12 years. And today, they're looking at expanding their bottle bill to liquor containers and to wine containers in addition to water containers so that they may capture more money for their general fund. That's the pessimistic argument that many people in Massachusetts are making, that this has gone beyond a litter bill to actually fund the state of Massachusetts. Now, they've taken this money and put it into an environmental fund that funds not only the bottle bill, but also curbside programs and other environmental programs in the state of Massachusetts. It's time for us to look at the bottle bills that have come since our bill, look at some of the things that they have done in order to improve their system. It's time to improve our bill. And we think that this study is a first step in identifying exactly how much money there is in unredeemed deposits. I went to a meeting earlier this year at OLCC where the industry allowed that for every percent of unredeemed deposits in the state of Oregon, it's $1 million. So it is not peanuts. It's a lot of money. And we urge you to consider this bill as a first step towards renovating our bill and making our bill truly one of the best in the country. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And we'll call Paul Roman. And we would ask everybody testifying to try to hold it to 4 minutes if you can.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've never spoken for less than 4 minutes in my entire life.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. This bill has been before you in the past, in previous years, as most things concerning the bottle bill have. And I want to apologize right now because I think I must represent the stupidest people on earth because they made millions and millions of dollars off the bottle bill, yet we spend a fortune trying to kill any expansion of the bottle bill. And we've spent, I was just at a national beer wholesalers meeting where we agreed to pay $20,000 to the state of Connecticut distributors because they were going to try and get out of the bottle bill. But we are making a lot of money, but we just don't know that. We're trying to figure this out. I have a suggestion for you. Actually, we would love to be taken out of the bottle bill, and the recyclers and the grocers can have all the millions that we're making. I have a suggestion for you, and it's legitimate. I think what you should do is, if you want to change the bottle bill, you should originate the deposit with the grocer. In other words, don't even have the distributor involved. We'll just distribute the product. Have all the funds sent to the state. Have the grocer then apply for a refund on which whatever they redeem, and then they can get rid of all this valuable product, the aluminum and the plastic and everything. They can take it all, and you can keep all the excess. The only thing I ask is that you give me at least a 20-year commitment that you're not going to bring us back in 2 years later when you find out that there is no money there. You'll hear a little bit later from a soft drink distributor. By the way, Crink, I set up Crink, container recovery that Sandra was talking about. I set it up because the bottle bill was the biggest pain in the behind for distributors. And we needed a critical mass, basically, to, in effect, count, sort, look at this stuff, try and figure out how much was out there. Because we were getting hammered whenever we went to pick up stuff at a grocery store. Because as most of the state does today, we don't count bottles and cans. The only place where bottles and cans are counted is in the 5-county area covered by Crink, because they have a critical mass where they actually bring it in, process it, and count everything. Everything else is based on dollars in, dollars out. So first of all, what you have in this bill, which is a requirement that we tell you the amount that we redeem in numbers of containers, we can't do outside of 5 areas. We don't count. You can't count this stuff. It's too labor intensive unless you have a critical mass. So every place else outside of Crink, we can't tell you the numbers. We can tell you how much dollars we paid out and how many dollars we brought back in. And the dollars statewide run about 98%. Container Recovery has done an audited analysis of 53% of the state for as far as numbers of containers. That, those are their numbers. This last year, it was a little low, with 97 point something. But the bottom line is, it's impossible for us to be redeeming at that high level if we're not getting stuff from out of state. So I brought my props with me. Now, I didn't have a chance to get my favorite prop, which is a different beverage, but this was the only thing that was available here. But on these containers, you see this is a Pepsi container, and it has all the bottle bill states listed on it. This is a Dr. Pepper container, and the lid has Oregon refund 5 cents and also says California redemption value. But it's sold in Washington State, too. And what happens is an empty container of Dr. Pepper or beer, an empty container is worth 5 cents. A case of empties sometimes is worth more than a case of fulls, because you have put an artificial value on this. And what we do is we get an enormous amount of cross-border traffic. The only way to track this, it was just sort of a guesstimate more than anything else, but I believe that Pepsi actually developed a separate UPC code. Most people don't. And what they found in like the Jansen Beach area, and I believe that somebody will testify, I don't know if you're going to be testifying about the numbers up there, but it was something like 40% of the containers that came across from Pepsi were Washington State containers.
We are at 4 minutes.
Pardon?
We are at 4 minutes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, briefly, I look forward to the day when a case of empty Budweiser cans are worth more than a case full.
Well, I didn't say quality-wise. This is dollar-wise.
So do you want to wrap up your testimony?
I will wrap up my testimony by telling you that this bill, first of all, we cannot comply with this bill. There's no way for us without an enormous amount of costs to actually count containers. We just can't do that outside of the Portland metro area. And we can say the dollars in, dollars out. You're going to get the same figures that Container Recovery talked about today. And again, I plead with you, if you want to take us out of the bottle bill, if you want to have all this wealth that we have somehow hidden away, please take us out. Let the grocers have it. We will love you forever for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate it. Committee, we are going to allow you to make your way out into the corridor where dinner pizza has been provided by some of the lobby, and I believe that applies to the audience as well. But we will intend to keep the hearing going. So please be sure to come back. So we are now at, let's see, that was an again. So now we're to the four, Joe Gillum.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Joe Gillian for the Oregon Grocery Association. And since I bought the pizza, you have to stay in here until I'm done. You can wait 4 minutes, please. Real quickly to the bill, I mean, I think you just heard a lot of descriptions about what may or may not happen, what will or won't happen. I would love to have all this money Paul's talking about, but frankly what it comes down to is what this bill is about. I don't know how much is in what they call these sheet funds, the unredeemed value. I don't know if we are over-redeeming as a total around the state. No one knows that. But there is a way to find out. We're willing to do our part to find that out, because we believe that in discussion of the bottle bill and changing it in any manner, whether you're talking about expansion, raising the deposit, redemption centers, curbside, anything, the talk always comes back to, is there any money to do this? And Senator Bishop was right. There is no public money. There is consumer money in the bottle bill. That's the only money that exists. So the nickels the consumers decide to throw away by putting their containers in recyclable in the curbside or throwing in the garbage or in the bottom of the lake or in a campfire, those are the nickels that are available. The grocery industry gets none of it. We pay for the bottle bill straight out of our pockets. The nickels go right over the top of our heads between distributors and consumers. There may not be enough money to cover the cost of handling all the cans. Paul may be right. But I will tell you, there is an accounting system that anybody can use, and whether you can take the distributors out of the bill, you can take restaurants are really inconsequential to the bill because they don't have a lot of outside traffic. Containers don't leave their establishment and come back. We're really the majority of the containers in the state. And we keep track of deposits as they come over the barcode, and we keep track of which items are under the bottle bill as far as our inventory. So we're willing to support and do our part in finding out what the number is. And we don't know. We know at times our number in one chain has been as high as $1 million based on our store brand pop. Because we're the originator, so we have in a sheet. And it's been as high as $1 million in a year. So we know it can't happen. So we're willing to report by glass, plastic, and aluminum, not by brand name or by drink type, because that's proprietary as far as market shares, but as far as type, willing to do that. And willing to do it for the amount sold and the amount redeemed in order to just get to a number. If there's not enough money there, great. Let's move on to the next discussion about the bottle bill, because you're going to have to find some way to fund it if you decide to do any changes to it. If the money is there, how much? Is it worth going after? If it's not, leave it alone. Whatever. This is just about getting a number. So all the gloom and doom you just heard about, I'd ask you just to shake it off and look at the bill for what it is. That's the only reason we're willing to support the bill. We're not supporting expansion or anything right now.
Okay, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This issue of bottles being transported into the state in order to obtain the Oregon State redemption, is that an issue you're familiar with, and do you have any sense of how big of an issue that is?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, that does exist. I mean, there are certain people who will bring the cans over the border and stand there at a machine and shove them in the machine for a nickel apiece. So it does exist. We don't have conclusive information from all retailers or all distributors on how much that is. This bill would get at that. If we had all retailers reporting, we could look at those stores on the border towns and say, what's your over-redemption rate and how high is it? And is it enough to say what Paul says is to offset the amount of cans that are thrown outside the system in some manner? But right now, we just truly don't know unless all retailers are reporting. And we'd like to see the distributors in, but it's also doable without the distributors if they would like to, as Paul said, get out at any chance.
Okay. So you are proposing amendments, is that correct?
I think the language of the bill, of what we understand, what I gave you is kind of the terms in which we can support the bill, needs some work. It didn't have a one-year. This is a one-year project. Our guys are going to do it for 1 year, give you the numbers, rather than an ongoing reporting requirement. And I think some of the language is a little loose on it. Probably needs to be worked over. And so if that's a decision of the committee, they want to take them out, then do it at that time.
Okay.
We're not going to carry it away.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one more question?
One more question, quickly, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be possible, if the Grocery Association is engaged in this, simply to do a survey without the state involved, the grocery stores of the state, if you will, to cover most of the traffic and could figure out what they sell versus what they redeem?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I don't think you'd get a complete enough number of the stores, because we don't have every store in the association. You're going to cut your sampling down again. I think you're going to get a more accurate number if you have us all in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call Ken Castega, who is on the against side. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm chairman and committee. My name is Ken Pastega. I'm from Corvallis, and we have bottling businesses in Medford, Corvallis, and Tillamook, Oregon, and used to do business in Klamath Falls. Anyway, our family's been in the soft drink business for 55 years not long after I was put on this earth, but anyway. The Oregon Bottle Bill is not the mechanism that started out in this state. We've had deposits ever since we've been in business. And those deposits were put in place to manage our containers, to get them back from the consumer. And all the Oregon Bottle Bill did was enhance it a little bit, because cans came into place and there was no deposit on cans at the time. But at the time the Oregon Bottle Bill was put in place, 85% of our business was done in glass containers. And, of course, that has changed now. But the deposits were put in place to help offset the container costs and to reduce the cost to the end consumer. And right now you're considering unclaimed deposits. And if there's any income to be earned here, we're paying taxes on it. Deposits also help offset the handling that we do right now with the containers. We weren't in the recycling business, but now we're in the recycling business, and we're not in the Portland metropolitan area, so we recycle every container within our own organization, in our building, and also in all the locations that we service in the state of Oregon. And also, if anything, it helps reduce the cost to the consumer. We're now filing annually all the deposits that we pick up with the OLCC, and that seems to be working fine. Pepsi-Cola, we put a different UPC code because the bottler in Portland, where Portland and Medford and Klamath Falls and Bend were experiencing containers coming from out of state. So we went to the Pepsi-Cola company and said, we've got to somehow control this. And so we do have different UPC codes for the state of Oregon to manage the over-redemption of containers, at least with our products. Now there are no costs to administer this process, and we feel like if the state gets involved in it, we're going to incur costs that basically are going to get passed on to consumers. So our family views this as a potential tax on the Oregon consumers, and we would recommend against it. We also, the Oregon Soft Drink Association, which I am a past president of, has put in place, we're going to try a pilot program at the Oregon State University to have the education department go out into the community of Corvallis and teach recycling to elementary kids so we can help curbside recycling. So we won't have to worry about consumers putting in deposit containers into landfills. So hopefully this next year we will put that into place. We're working with the education department of Oregon State University, and hopefully we'll have a positive program there and take it down to the University of Oregon, which they will support it by making it part of the curriculum for the education department to go out into the school systems and teach recycling. And that's all I have to say, and I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Ken. We appreciate your family's contribution to the business climate in Oregon.
Thank you.
We know you're very successful, and we appreciate your work.
Thank you.
And I don't think there are questions.
I have a question,
Representative Rosenbaum.
Not for this witness, maybe for Representative Berger. It's not clear to me, looking at the bill, whether it's intended to track containers on which there is no deposit currently collected, because the language would seem to be all glass, all aluminum, and all plastics.
Representative Rosenbaum, thank you, Madam Chair. I asked the Legislative Council, and they said in the first section there is a reference to the original bottle bill, and it only applies to those containers that are currently under the bottle bill. Because I asked that question to the Legislative Council and was assured that the reference to the bottle bill in the first section.
All right, we have two witnesses left, and they are for the bill, so I'd like to call them up, Doug Myers and John Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm a lobbyist, proud lobbyist for Association of Oregon Recyclers, AOR, and I just want to say that this bill is not about expanding the bottle bill to non-carbonated drinks, and it's not about increasing the 5 cents to something closer to what 5 cents was 30 years ago. This is about just finding out what the sheet is, and that's the point I want to make, and I'll yield the balance of my time to John Matthews.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, committee members, my name is John Matthews. I've been in the recycling business since 1970, the year before the bottle bill passed. And I'm currently a recycling coordinator for Garden Services, the year recycling vendor for this building in the state of Oregon. I'm representing only myself in this testimony and as a member of Association of Oregon Recyclers. I believe it's There's a lot of unanswered questions about the effectiveness of the bottle bill, which this study can help answer. Certainly in today's economic times, a question of perhaps $10 to $12 million of consumer unredeemed composites might be an interesting question for the legislature to hear the answer to. One part of the bottle bill, the one group that is affected by the bottle bill that has probably suffered with the least amount of compensation has been the retailer. So that's a point. I think it's important that all the parties would have an interest in understanding what the percentage of redemption is and how much money might be there. And from that point, when one can go further to after that, those questions are answered. But this is just a step to understand what monies are not being redeemed by our bottle bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our witnesses on House Bill 3021. I think we have indications that there's a lot of people for and a lot of people against it, so we will not intend to move it at this time. Thank you all for coming. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 3021. And committee, we're going to recess for 5 minutes, give us a chance to get something to eat, and we have one more bill left, and we will go right into that in 5 minutes. Thank you.
Chair, there's a spreadsheet on the second page that I think helps outline. It's a complex issue, and with power being out in a competitive market, it has not really taken off for a large number of reasons: complexity, economy, other scandals and such that have gone on in the energy market and such. But last year was the first year that we had an opportunity to actually have a competitive bid. And in that first experience, we found out a couple things going through the process and trying to find competitive numbers for our members. I will tell you, this is a big number for the grocery stores. A few years ago, just 4 years ago, they were paying an average of about $11,000 for your average supermarket per month. They now pay about $17,000 per month for power in a grocery store. So it's a large expense item for any grocery store and a big decision to make each year if you're trying to find the best price that will affect your grocery prices as you go along. If you look at the spreadsheet, everything on the top half of the black line in the middle really describes the current process. And if you're the PG Service District, which is, let me say up front too, and for the other members in the back, this bill was not intended to include public utility districts. They are not governed by the PUC and are not intended to be in the bill. And apparently we need to redefine electric utilities as electric companies in order to make sure that is done, so that we'd have to do some work on the bill. But they're not included in our bill. But what happens is if you follow January 2002, there's a date put out by PGE that says we need to know if you're going to be in or out of our service for January of 2004. Back in January of 2002, they want to know if you're going to be in or out for January of 2003. But a price is not given, so you're forced to make a decision a year in advance for your power costs in the dark, like playing poker in the dark. You have no idea what the price is going to be. So if you stay in, you say, I will stay with you, PGE. They in turn go out and find power, but they don't announce that price until November 15th of that year. So you have this 11-month waiting game. At the time they announce the price, you can make a decision whether to stay or leave again. But if you opted in January, you'll pay a penalty to get out now, even though you didn't know what the price was going to be. If you opted out and want to come back in, you're going to pay a fee to get back in the circle. On top of that, there's a deadline issue. PG last year announced their price at 5 p.m. on Friday night and gave till 5 p.m. on Monday to decide whether you're going to be in the game or not, leaving the weekend and Monday to determine competitive prices and their prices, whether you're going to buy from PGE or opt out and do all these complex decisions. It's one thing if you have a large staff and you can do that. The large chains, some of them on the spot market, they have somebody who watches the market. They buy it daily. Sometimes they don't need brokers. They don't need this situation. But your local grocery stores, your Thriftways, your Food for Lesses, and things like that don't have that type of staff, and they can't just kind of make those decisions. This is true, for other small businesses that I think JL will speak to. So what we propose is to take some of those barriers out of the system and to say that the date the prices come out will be determined by the PUC rather than by the utility. So they'll set the date, and then after that date, you'll have 5 business days in which to select if you want to stay with that price or opt out and go to another competitive buyer. In addition to that, there would be no penalties if there was a January deadline to say you're going to be in for a year later. They could have that to get a measurement of their buying power. However, they couldn't penalize you for opting in or out if you found a better price in the open market for providers in the state. So that's really all we're trying to accomplish is not to have these short deadlines, to have business days, and not to have penalties if we're asked to make a choice in the dark without knowledge of price.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Close and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB with 12,000 small business members. I want to introduce to the committee one of my members, Charlie Tregesser, with Polar Systems in Portland, just to give you a real-life example of how this issue interplays with the small business community.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Tregesser. I'm the President and CEO of Polar Systems. Been in business in Portland for 22 years doing local and wide area computer networks for our customers. We are a small business, and we don't pay $11,000 a month for power. In fact, we only pay about $450 to $500 a month for our electricity. However, for a small business like ours, that's an important expenditure, and it's important enough for me to take a look at what the cost could be, as I've done in the past for other things like telephone and long distance and so forth through our business lines. And I've managed through deregulation to save money in those areas and, in fact, improve my service. In an attempt to put some cost controls in place for our power, I tried to take advantage of what I thought was going to become some deregulation and some open competition. I was led to believe by all the things that were published that there was going to be open competition, so I spent time and went in and tried to research through BGE's website about 7 electric service providers that were supposedly going to be in the game to offer me the opportunity to shop them for price. As I went through the process, I found that, in fact, the process was very complicated. No one seemed to know exactly how it was supposed to work. I couldn't tell when I had to opt out, how I had to opt out, who I had to opt out with, what that meant. It meant something about I had to say it in January, and I couldn't get out until the end of the year. But it was really going to be for even a year after that. I mean, it was just very, very complicated. And then in the final analysis, after doing a lot of research on this, I even got to the point where I tried to have PGE and one of the energy service providers that I had selected to do business with to try to have them on a conference call at one time. And it was all set up, and then I was told by the PGE people that their management had told them they could not participate in a call like that. They could talk with me, the customer. I could talk with the electric service provider. PGE could talk to the provider, but not all three of us could be on the phone at one time. Eventually, I got to the point where I asked to have a meeting with, at least a telephone conversation with the CEO of PGE. I figured, well, if I'm the CEO of a small business, small as it may be, maybe she would talk with me. But that was denied also. All I'm telling you is that it's supposed to be open competition. It's working in other utilities. There is a way for a small business like mine to be able to save money with open competition. But there's really not been open competition to this point. I think this bill will help us get there. Thank you. If you have any questions.
Thank you for being with us tonight. Appreciate it. Representative Berkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, did you happen to opt out and then have to opt back into PG&E, or did you pay a penalty, or how did it end up working? What was the conclusion of the story?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I actually did send them a fax at one point in time opting out, but it must have got disregarded. Along the lines, you know, after all of this research and debating as to what was going to happen, I was finally told that the rate schedule that I'm on, which is Schedule 32, had nowhere to go, that I could opt out, but I there wasn't an electric service provider that would be there to catch me. And so that if I did opt out, I would have to go to some spot market pricing of monthly or weekly or daily pricing, which means you're at the mercy of the marketplace, and that's not a good idea, I've been told. But, I mean, it wasn't until very late in the game that that was determined, and I'm not sure exactly why that was. Possibly because none of these seven providers could come to terms with PGE to be able to be accepted into the program.
Thank you.
Very confusing.
Other questions? Okay, Jale.
Thank you. Chair Close and members, as Joe and Charlie illustrated, I'm looking for some method to achieve seamless transition from one provider to another if a business opts to do that. I think one of the days we can look back as kind of sucking the air out of the Oregon economy is when there was a 53% rate increase that was put into effect by PGE. And, you know, I think you could hear some of our companies closing down as a result. And so my point is, if that's going to be the case, at least give businesses, small businesses, the opportunity to transition to someone else or to choose competitors if you're going to say that we have a competitive market. So I am very interested in giving small business opportunity. We've made a policy decision that deregulation is where we're going to go. And if that's the case, then let there be competition in the truest sense. Someone like Charlie ought to be able to have a place to go, unencumbered, without penalty, without hoops. Our name is on House Bill 3487, which allows open access all year long. But I'm willing to stump for 3376, which gives a 5-day window from which to choose and make those choices, because maybe that's what we have to come down to. Either way, the philosophy is still the same. If we're going to have deregulation, then there ought to be a seamless way for small businesses to be able to choose who they want to provide their electricity. It's really as simple as that as far as we're concerned.
Representative Gallego,
do you know if this... If there is, have you tried working with the PUC to know whether they could do any of these things in by rule? Or do you know if it has to be by legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, it may be able to be done at the PUC. Most small businesses don't have the resources to go and hire somebody to go challenge at the PUC, to be quite frankly. It usually requires some legal expertise at the PUC, and they don't have the money to go do that and make those kind of challenges. Madam Chair, I did want to point out one thing in Section 1, just to clarify. This bill would require all electric companies or suppliers to put their number up on the date prescribed by the PUC. Not just, this isn't a pick-on, sounds like a pick-on PGE bill, but we like sending too much to do that. So it's a matter of all electric suppliers put their number up on the same date prescribed. So everybody has to sharpen their pencil and put their best number out there. And then the consumer gets to make a choice based on who's bought the best or provides the best product. We just want time to do that.
Thank you very much. We do have our public utility commissioners here today, and they've been waiting patiently. So we'd like to call forward Roy Hemingway and also Lee Byer. Thanks for joining us for dinner and a discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Roy Hemingway, Chair, Oregon Public Utility Commission, and with me is Lee Byer, Public Utility Commissioner. This is a bill with which we have some sympathy because this is a problem that we have noticed, but we don't think it's necessarily the right solution. The legislature in 1999 passed the optional open access to alternative suppliers bill that said that on March 1 of 2002, commercial and industrial customers will have the opportunity to have a supplier other than their regular utility. And our predecessors at the commission trying to work through the complicated problems that actually laid out, because the law also says there shouldn't be any subsidy between the customers that leave and the customers who stay. That is, in other states, customers who stay on the system sometimes have helped to subsidize the costs of those who leave. But in Oregon, if you leave the system and you leave costs with the utility system, those costs end up having to be paid by someone, and our law says they're paid by the ones who leave. So that's the law we were left with, our predecessors were left with implementing. It's very clear that the current system doesn't work because no commercial or industrial customer has signed up with an alternate supplier. Now, we are committed to making deregulation work in Oregon for those customers who want to have an alternate supplier. And I would say one of our one or two top priorities at the commission that we all agree on is to make this system work so that customers who want to leave can leave and have and don't feel that they're saddled with a lot of process or too much cost before they choose an alternate supplier. So what we have done is we have asked our staff to go out and interview stakeholders, companies who might leave the system or might consider it, utilities, everyone who might have an interest in this, and if there are others here who feel that they haven't been heard, we're eager to hear from them, and find out what they think are the problems. We know that the waiting period is a problem. We don't know if the solution is expanding it to 5 days, to 10 days, a month, or doing away with it altogether. But it's something that we know is a problem. We've heard from the suppliers and from the customers that it's a problem. We also know that the transition charges are a problem. That is, they don't give any incentive for anyone to leave. That is, if you leave, you get socked with virtually the difference between the price you got from the utility and the price you were getting from the new supplier anyway. And so we want to work this out, and we have set up a process by which we think we can work this out as a commission. On the 1st of May, we'll be holding a workshop in which we hear from our staff and hear from stakeholders about this question, and we imagine that that's going to lead to a rulemaking where we will rethink this whole process. We respect the legislature's role here, but with all due respect, we don't think that this is a problem that needs a legislative solution at this time.
Well, I appreciate knowing that you're aware of it and you're working on it. That gives a little comfort.
If I might add, Madam Chair, members, I think the issue here is not the awareness of the problem. The issue is trying to resolve and balance the goals, as Chairman Hemingway was talking about. How do you have open access and not have a subsidy of the people who either will leave? That's really part of the issue there. That's in other states, and certainly there are a number of states who have done this, they made that decision up front, and they decided that they would indeed buy down the transition costs either through a tax mechanism or other mechanisms, just so that you didn't have that issue. We've chosen in Oregon not to do that, but to try to balance it with everybody paying their own way. That's difficult to do. It's very difficult to do. The whole issue of energy is something that's very complex now. We've gone through rather revolutionary times in terms of spikes, and we've seen electricity go as high as $3,500 a megawatt and as low as $2 a megawatt in the last 24 months. So it's not a comfortable time to try and jump into the market, and I certainly appreciate those business people who've tried to figure out how to do that. But what I've learned from this is that we're going to have to try and fine-tune this process, and we communicated with the legislature on the restructuring bill earlier this session and suggested that you not touch 1149 and give it another 2 years, and I guess that's still the position that we would offer to you. We are committed to try and make it work. I don't know whether we will end up making it work. There are a lot of problems, but we're committed to trying to make that work, and I think that the best
approach is probably to allow us to try to do that through administrative rules rather than fixing changes in statute at this point. You may want to do that later, but I think it's too early to make those changes.
Commissioner Beyer, I think of particular concern is this, announcing prizes 5 p.m. on a Friday and then giving the deadline 5 p.m. Monday.
I agree.
Is real unworkable, unreasonable, in my opinion.
I absolutely agree.
Is that something you can consider in your work group?
That is something we set afterwards. Part of the issue that's there is for the utility announcing the prices, they have to try and guess how much power they're going to buy and lock into contracts. And the length of period kind of fluctuates a little bit in terms of how the market's going to treat that. That's one side of the issue. The other side is, and I appreciate the sort of the nature of the energy suppliers. Others, we've got 7 energy suppliers, and I believe it's 4 aggregators that are signed up to do business in Oregon, none of which have done business in Oregon. But sort of the nature of having a marketplace is they're not going to want to post their prices because their price is going to be dependent on what they can go out and contract with individuals to do. They're going to want to have some flexibility because as a consumer, what you're trying to bid against or buy against is what kind of deal can you cut from someone other than the incumbent utility? That's the deal. So they need some flexibility on it. Much like, I guess, through a certain industry we regulate, telephones, the competitive telephone providers, their place in the marketplace is having the freedom to offer rates at different times around the regulated rate. That's how you get the competition. So it's complicated in that. The other piece I would note is the phrase penalty here. I'm not exactly sure what the sponsors meant by this, but I think what they meant is the transition charge. That's not really viewed as a penalty. That's an actual real cost that somebody has to pay. The question is who pays it.
Well, I guess beyond that, it's if you declare in January and you have to declare clear to November, then that's a huge time period.
That's just really an announcement of an intent. They don't have to follow up on that intent. Correct me if I say this wrong, but it's to give an intent to the utility of what the potential market that they will be buying power for.
But they are penalized for that, is that correct?
They're not penalized. At the point when they make the selection under the current regime, they say, a customer would say, I'm thinking about going into the marketplace in January, and under the current schedule, then in October, November, when it's announced, they would make the election to whether to go or not. And they're not really penalized at that point. After that point, if they choose to go into the market, they're penalized in terms of they can't get immediately back. The law says we have to let them back into the system, into a regulated rate. But there's a cost there because the utility hasn't bought the power for them if they come back. We need to be clear about this. There's risk to anybody jumping out from under a regulated rate. There's risk of being in the marketplace.
Sam Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just expand a little bit, either of you, actually, on this notion of transition costs? What kind of real costs are we talking about?
Well, and let's take the situation where utility has bought power plants at a relatively high, or power contracts, long-term power contracts, at a relatively high cost. And the market goes low, and customers want to leave the utility. In that circumstance, the utility ends up with these costs, and someone has to pay them. The regulatory contract, as we call it, requires that the utility get an authorized rate of return regardless of how many customers they have, and they're not expected to lose money by virtue of us creating a competitive environment. And so that cost either ends up being paid for by the existing customers who are left, and of course if you keep piling that greater cost on the existing customers, more and more will leave, and eventually you don't have anybody left.
It's the death spiral.
That's the death spiral. And so states all over who have done deregulation have come up with this idea of transition costs, and that is these costs get loaded onto the customer who leaves. Now, it can be the reverse, where there are actual transition benefits. That is, if the market price is higher than the cost of the power that the utility has, then if somebody leaves, the utility can market that power at a higher price, and the utility actually will write a check to the customer who leaves. Now, you can do this on a one-time basis, as has been done in many other states, a snapshot to determine what transition costs are, or you can do it as Oregon has done, which is do it on a year-by-year basis. We're finding doing it on a year-by-year basis is very complicated and has ended up providing virtually no incentive to anybody to leave. And so that's one of the things that we want to be talking about in our workshop and our rulemaking, is how can we get out of this annual transition charge that ends up so that nobody has any reason to leave the utility.
Sam Gallegos.
To follow up on really an issue that was raised here, with, especially with the small business folks who have maybe difficulty having access to the PUC and working that process. I mean, that was the implication that, or that, you know, why wouldn't they come and work with the PUC?
I
don't know. So are you going to accommodate the small businessmen in May 1st in your workshop and the rulemaking to help accommodate their needs for working in this process?
Representative Gallegos, I would hope that they would find our process as friendly as they find the legislature, at least.
Oh.
In that, and we are trying to have set a process that's somewhat informal. We have a variety of processes sometimes that require an attorney to represent an interest, but in this case we want to do this in a workshop format, which means all of us sitting around a table trying to roll up our sleeves and get to the heart of the issue. So I would welcome the representatives of the particular industries that we're talking, particularly small business. They are the folks that are at the heart of this program, and so we want to hear from them, and too often we don't.
I might add that during the last 3 months, since the last time we went out, our staff has actually gone out and met in businesses. It's tended to be some of the larger users, but I think there's been a smattering of both. Those most likely go out and actually sit down, and because we felt we had to go out and say, okay, what's the barrier? What's in the way to doing this? And that's what we're going to get the formal report in the next couple of weeks on that. And we're honestly trying to figure out how to make this work. I can't promise that we will, because lots of states are having trouble, but we're giving it the old honest try to make it work.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate you taking so much time
being
with us and educating us on this. Our last person to testify is Cindy Finlayson, and so we want to give the utilities a chance to defend themselves. I notice our two gentlemen with utilities are not coming up. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Finlayson, and I represent Portland General Electric. And we are opposing House Bill 3376, and it's not because we don't think this is a legitimate issue. We do. We think this is one of many, many detail issues that still have to be worked out. Remember that when Senate Bill 1149 passed, it was really a shell. There were no real details in it, and it was new to Oregon, it's new to the utilities, and we are working very hard to try to resolve the issues for our customers. But remember that we have customers that can choose and customers that don't get to choose, and so we have to make sure that we balance the issues and that we balance all of the costs to make sure that there aren't cost shifts from one group to another. And we believe that the legislature probably isn't the appropriate place to be dealing with the details of Senate Bill 1149, because as markets shift, economies shift, when Senate Bill 1149 was first enacted, it's every session since, we've had changes because the market has changed, the economy has changed, customers' needs have changed. So have utilities needs. And certainly our company's had its issues. We've only been doing this for a year. We are committed to working it out at the PUC. We're committed to open access. We supported the bill in 1999, and we want to continue to work with it. But we think that it's probably not appropriate to do it here, because what if 5 days isn't enough? What if we find out 5 days isn't enough? The next opportunity to change that will be next legislative session, if it's in statute. And I think that we need the flexibility that the PUC offers us to deal with the uncertainty and the volatility in the market, and basically as we work out the details of this bill. So, thank you. That's all I really have.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks.
Committee, that concludes our witnesses on this issue. Thank you for your attention. If there's nothing else for the good of the committee, we will see you in the morning.
8 a.m. tomorrow.
8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay.
We are adjourned.